Thank you so very much. It's 5 minutes past the hour, and it is my pleasure to announce that this is Deborah Heart and Lung Center Presents. And today, our distinguished expert is Dr. Howard Waxman, pulmonologist at Deborah Heart and Lung Center, board certified in both pulmonary disease and critical care medicine. Dr. Waxman earned his medical degree at Boston University School of Medicine. After medical school, he completed a residency in internal medicine at Bronx Municipal Medical Center, Albert Einstein Hospital. He has completed a fellowship in pulmonary and critical care medicine at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York. Dr. Waxman has a special interest in advanced diagnostic bronchoscopy. He authored articles in peer-reviewed medical journals and is a tremendous source and expert in his field. Today's topic on Deborah Heart and Lung Center Presents is understanding emphysema. Dr. Waxman, welcome to your program, sir. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to be with you. So let's not bury the lead. We'll get right into it. What is emphysema?
Well, emphysema is actually one subcategory of a larger category of disease called COPD. And in people who have emphysema, what's really happening is that there is damage to lung tissue in the more peripheral parts of the area beyond the small airways that are constantly branching out as you get further into the lung. And so there's damage to the segments of lung that are responsible for absorbing oxygen and getting rid of carbon dioxide. And more importantly, what ends up happening is the bronchial passages themselves become narrow and tend to collapse. So it's difficult to move air in and out of the lungs overall, which only aggravates the symptoms.
The signs and symptoms of emphysema are?
Very similar to a lot of other types of what we call obstructive airways disease, meaning that anything that causes narrowing of the bronchial passages is going to present primarily with symptoms of shortness of breath, cough, and oftentimes that cough will be a not very productive one, meaning that even if you feel a sense of congestion, you just can't generate enough force and enough airflow to expel whatever mucus and other material is in the airways. Some people will get a sense of chest heaviness or pain from overworked breathing muscles, and they will have fatigue and limitation in their ability to perform activity.
You are listening to Dr. Howard Waxman, pulmonologist at Deborah Heart and Lung Center. And to make an appointment, you can call 609-621-2080. That's 609-621-2080. Or from any digital device at demanddeborah.org, demanddeborah.org. And I know we're not going to prescribe, you know, any consultation with specifics over the air, but a listener did write me. I've been advertising that you were going to be coming on, and a listener wrote me with a specific situation. I referred them to make an appointment at Deborah Heart and Lung Center, but here's what they wrote me. They say they breathe normally. They don't have any problem breathing. They walk, they go up steps, you know, and they're not gasping for air. But they said that when they're laying down at times, they hear a wheeze when they're breathing. But then if they take a deep breath, the gentle lady tells me that she gets good air exchange and that the wheeze is not there, but that they've noticed that this wheeze has started. So I said, look, I'll pose it, but I'm recommending that you make the appointment. I'm sure you've heard something like that before. When you hear that, what can you say about that?
It's actually a much more complex question than she may realize, because there are several things that happen when you change body position like that. First and foremost, and having nothing to do with the lungs themselves, there are going to be shifts in terms of where fluid goes when you change position, simply based on gravity. So in the same way, for example, that some people will describe having swollen and puffy ankles by the end of the day, but when they lay down or elevate their legs, they look better. Well, that fluid isn't disappearing. It's simply shifting into different parts of their body. So in some people, the shifts in fluid include shifts into either the airways, like the bronchial passages, or into the tissue surrounding the throat. So you can have noisy breathing because essentially the noise is a sound of turbulence. So when the airway is narrow, airflow is no longer smooth and easy, and that turbulent flow creates a different sort of sound, which can be perceived as wheezing. So sometimes it could just be a change in fluid rather than due to intrinsic disease of the lung. Sometimes it has to do with other factors that come into play when you lay down. So, for example, people who have acid reflux may have that aggravated by position, but acid reflux can itself trigger cough and wheeze and bronchial constriction. So it's actually a somewhat complex question where you can really only answer in generalities unless you know details about the patient.
And that's why I referred her to make an appointment, 609-621-2080 or demanddebord.org. And I just knew you were going to hit that out of the park. We are visiting with Dr. Howard Waxman, pulmonologist at Deborah Heart and Lung Center. Our topic this half hour on Deborah Heart and Lung Center Presents Dr. Waxman is understanding emphysema. So we're going to know a lot that we never knew before by the end of this program with Dr. Waxman. Dr. Waxman, what are the controllable risk factors that can cause emphysema?
Well, that's the low-lying fruit because the easiest, the easiest target for me is always going to be smoking. And sad to say, it is the single most important contributing factor to people developing emphysema. There are other risk factors as well, exposure to certain other kinds of particulate matter, dusts, and perhaps industrial products. So there are some people who will get disease related to a work-related exposure. But that is where you start blurring the lines between COPD as a group of diseases as opposed to emphysema as a specific destructive disease of the lungs. And when it comes to emphysema, the single biggest intervention a person can make is going to be to not take up smoking or to quit if they do smoke. And obviously, we wouldn't have a multi-billion dollar industry of trying to help people quit if it was all that easy. So it's definitely easier said than done.
You mentioned the smoking, which was so obviously important, but I want to forge on with this sort of theme. Who is most susceptible to contracting emphysema?
We don't know. There are certainly genetic factors at play. And one of the things that comes up when you discuss inborn risk factors is going to be a genetic condition called alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. There's a fair amount of evidence to show that it's more common than we appreciate, even within the medical community, and we need to do a better job at identifying patients who have that. And it definitely makes people more susceptible to emphysema. So, for example, if I have someone who comes in with COPD or emphysema and they are younger than the average person, so someone perhaps in their late 30s or 40s, it would be one of the conditions that I'm concerned about. On the other hand, if you look more broadly at who gets it and what percentage of people with emphysema have it because of an inborn tendency, the answer is it's a minority of patients. And within the larger population, we don't really have the ability to predict who's going to show up, for example, with symptoms that behave more like a chronic bronchitis as opposed to the person who's going to have more destructive changes in their lungs. Both of those groups are going to be people who have symptoms, and there's certainly no way to ever pronounce someone as being a safe smoker, for example. You can't ever analyze someone and say, well, in you, I don't mind that you're continuing to smoke, because we don't have the ability to predict that, not to mention all of the other associated diseases that go along with smoking. So we don't really know what creates the individual pattern that you'll see in any given smoker. We just know that statistically speaking, the people who smoke are the ones who are most likely to get emphysema.
I really appreciate the way you responded to the question in terms of we really don't know. And then you did mention briefly genetics. I want to specifically ask you about heredity. Do you find familial type things where it is passed around, passed down?
Yes. Now, the knowledge about that entity has been around for more than a generation. It's a well-known condition. If you look at the general population, it's probably one out of every 3,000 or 4,000 people who has that genetic predisposition. So it means that it may not be terribly common, but it certainly is not uncommon. And as with most other genetic conditions, the actual manifestation compared to simply having a gene can be variable as well. So you may have some people who, because of their particular mutation conferring a different level of risk, you may or may not be able to be precise in knowing when someone would get sick, but we certainly know that there are certain groups who are very likely to. The other part of the problem is, well, not so much a problem, but is that when you are simply a carrier, you may not know anything at all, because the carriers of this condition are not very likely to develop symptoms. And in fact, the medical literature on this is very mixed as far as saying whether a carrier who is themselves perhaps a smoker, whether they are actually more likely to get sick. There's a lot of conflicting evidence about that, which means that there may be many people who are at risk due to being carriers, and we just don't know how to identify them. Moreover, a person would not know whether their parents were carriers and whether, therefore, they are at elevated risk themselves. So it's actually a fairly complex problem.
That was so interesting, what you just shared. We're at halftime, believe it or not, and I knew it was going to fly by with Dr. Waxman because he is so interesting and the content of today's program so very important. When we come back, I think this is one of the most definitive, most important questions of today's program with Dr. Waxman, who is appearing on Deborah Heart and Lung Center Presents, and the topic is understanding emphysema, because I've never heard of early detection being anything other than a really good thing ever in my life. I mean, finding out anything, cancer, anything at the earliest possible time can mean everything. What stage in terms of, you know, prognosis and result and all of it. So early detection is so meaningful, and it inspires me to ask the question, when should you consult a pulmonologist like the great Dr. Howard Waxman regarding your lung and breathing conditions? That is the topic, the specific question, when we come back with Dr. Waxman in just a few minutes. Don't go away. I thank you very much. Welcome back. We are visiting with Dr. Howard Waxman, MD, pulmonologist at Deborah Heart and Lung Center. To make an appointment, you can call 609-621-2080. That's 609-621-2080. Or from any digital device, simply go to demanddeborah.org and you will see you can't miss it. I believe it's a nice big hyperlink, red block. It's just unmissable. Demanddeborah.org, and you can schedule your appointment directly from the web as well. The topic this half hour is understanding emphysema. I want to restate the question for listeners that may not have been with us right before the break. When, Dr. Waxman, should someone that's listening right now consult a pulmonologist such as you regarding lung and breathing conditions?
Well, I think it's important first to recognize that people don't go to the doctor and present with a diagnosis. No one comes in to see me saying, hello, I have emphysema, or at least they don't unless they've already seen another physician and received a diagnosis. Most people will just go to the doctor saying, I'm breathless, I'm coughing, and they'll have a variety of different respiratory symptoms that require investigation. And you also have to remember that the age at which most people will show up with symptoms is the same age that they show up with many other illnesses. Things like heart disease are also largely diseases of middle age or beyond. So one of the questions that's always going to go through the mind of the physician is this COPD or emphysema, because I have a middle-aged person who's a smoker, or is this heart disease, for example, because obviously smokers are at elevated risk for that as well. So if you have a patient who's a smoker and has respiratory symptoms, the first step is always for them to present to their primary care physician and try to come up with a sense of whether the symptoms demonstrate a pattern that might point you in a particular direction. fortunately, when it comes to testing for COPD, our testing is fairly simple, not invasive, not uncomfortable, and it's a pretty quick test where after about 15 or 20 minutes, you can have a clear sense of whether that person's lung function is diminished. So it's easily enough managed, and in terms of when it should show up, it depends on the individual, because if a person is more proactive, they may go to the doctor saying to themselves, well, I'm a smoker, I want to make sure I don't get sick, I want to know that I'm not on the road towards illness already, so let me go and just get checked out. But certainly if someone has symptoms of breathlessness or any kind of limitations to their activities, first step is to make sure that they know, is it heart or is it lung?
Mm, very important. Now, in terms of finding out that you have emphysema after consultation with you, Dr. Mm-hmm. Waxman, is this, once you have it, you've got it for life and now you're managing it? Or are there things you can do that would remedy the situation?
Well, you got to realize that most of the diseases that physicians treat nowadays are manageable but not curable.
Yeah.
So to say that emphysema is not curable is no different than saying that diabetes or high blood pressure are not curable. But all three of those diseases are certainly manageable and treatable. But the brief answer is no, you cannot regenerate lost lung tissue or regrow healthy tissue when it's already been damaged. And that's one of the reasons why we're so desperate to get people to quit smoking, to use respiratory protection if they have a high-risk occupation and so on, is because once it's lost, it can only be managed but not regained.
Another reason that early detection would be a really good idea, right?
Correct.
I think you talked about it, but I'm going to make it a standalone question anyhow as a point of emphasis. How is emphysema diagnosed? How do you actually find out that you go in there not knowing and you might come out being told, or how do you diagnose it?
It depends on the stage of the disease, because there are quite a few people out there who are sort of pre-symptomatic, where you might notice changes on an x-ray, and yet when you do lung function testing, you don't yet see any abnormalities. And that has to do with the fact that the lungs have so much reserve capacity to them that you actually have to lose a fair amount of healthy tissue to the disease before you're even going to notice symptoms. And it's quite a common occurrence where I'll see somebody sent to me because of an x-ray that was abnormal, and yet when we do testing, fortunately, they have normal lung function. And in the same way that you might tell a person in your office that they have prediabetes, and if they don't eat properly and exercise and perhaps get more fit and a bit more lean, that sooner or later they will have overt symptoms of diabetes. And in these very same situations with our lung patients, we may say to them, okay, you're already demonstrating changes of lung structure. Your lung function so far has not fallen off the edge of that cliff, but if you don't quit smoking or engage in health promoting behaviors, then sooner or later you will develop symptoms. So there are some people who certainly have changes that you might call emphysema on an x-ray, but who don't yet have symptoms. And then if you have someone who's already progressed to the point where they have symptoms, then there's a test that you do where you have them breathe through a machine that measures the quantity of air contained within the lungs and how vigorous the flow of air is through the bronchial passages. And changes in those two parameters are a reflection of how much damage has been done and help us in terms of determining the presence of the disease and its stage and severity.
You are listening to Deborah Heart and Lung Center presents Dr. Howard Waxman, pulmonologist at Deborah Heart and Lung Center. To make an appointment, you can call 609-621-2080, 609-621-2080, or from any digital device. Simply navigate to demanddeborah.org, and away you go, demanddeborah.org. We know in terms of cancer, for example, I think almost everybody is familiar. They hear stage 1, stage 2, stage 3, stage 4. What are the stages of emphysema?
They are derived from really a combination of things, but largely due to direct measurements of airflow and how much of an impairment in flow there is. The problem is that you don't want people, at least in their perception of it, to view it as progression the way they do with cancer, because even though obviously any disease that's more severe is more likely to cause symptoms or disability and death, it's not the case that if left untreated, you automatically progress from one stage to the next. So for example, if I have a patient who has what would be categorized as stage 2 COPD, meaning that their airflow has dropped to below about 80% of where it should be, if they quit smoking, their lung function is not going to continue to decline as if there's a process that's been set in motion where they will inevitably get worse. So that would differ, for example, from a cancer where if left untreated, a malignant cancer is going to progress. In smoking, if you remove the external influences, then a person's lungs are going to age at the same rate as the rest of their body. And so the staging is done to describe the severity and to some extent the prognosis, but it's important for them to understand that they have some degree of control if they avoid any of the factors that would make their lungs worse, which is very different from cancer, where unfortunately you have much less personal individual control over your disease.
What do you say? This is sort of just a wild card question I was just thinking about. What do you say to someone that's scared? I mean, you know, not being able to breathe properly. There aren't that many things that would be more scary than that. Right. And of course, if you get scared, you send your heart rate up and all this. But what do you say to someone that's scared about this type of prognosis?
Well, the first thing you don't tell them is calm down.
Right. calm down. Tell me not to calm down.
because, I mean, honestly, what I think you need is to sort of form a bit of a partnership with the patient where you make them understand that that no matter what is going on with their disease, we do have some measure of control over what we can do. Now, obviously, there are going to be some people who do have very far advanced disease, and you need to be open and honest with them about recognizing their limitations. But at the very same time, what they need to understand is that, for better or for worse, they have reached a point in their lives where they have to work at staying healthy. So they cannot receive health passively. No one gets stronger, for example, by resting. In fact, they get weaker. One of the mainstays of managing people with emphysema, for example, is we want them to exercise. So paradoxically, they will say, I'm short of breath when I'm active, and we tell them that we want them to be active, because if they're not, then their body will deteriorate, and that deterioration means that they will use their existing lung function less and less efficiently, and their breathing will feel worse even if their lungs have not become worse. So one of the things that we do is we have them engage in structured exercise programs to try to maintain fitness while at the same time having them use medications to open up the breathing passages and try to improve airflow as much as possible. So it has to be a global approach that includes proper nutrition, regular exercise, and medications, which means that the patient really does need to take an active role in their own health. And I think that sense that they do have some control over it sometimes will help reassure them and make them less frightened because they realize that they can do something about it.
Hearing that, the exercise component of it sounds counterintuitive, but when you explain it, it makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's important also because, you know, many people will use the analogy of heart disease, where they're afraid that they will damage their heart if they try to push through and overdo it. And I often will use that analogy when I'm seeing patients, and I'll remind them that shortness of breath in someone with emphysema does not mean that you're about to have a lung attack the way a cardiac patient might be afraid of a heart attack. And I tell them the breathlessness simply indicates that you may have hit your limits, and what we need to do is see how far we can extend those limits by improving your fitness while at the same time treating the disease with your medications.
You mentioned bronchitis and emphysema earlier in the program, so I'm going to skip past that because of time, because I want to get to these additional important questions as well. What are the long-term health effects, complications of emphysema?
Several things. First and foremost, again, it has to do with the fact that a natural inclination that many people will have would be to limit their activities. And when that happens, there's a whole cascade of events. They become less physically fit. Their cardiovascular risk increases. They may gain weight because of lower levels of activity, which then has a cascade effect on blood pressure and blood sugar and blood cholesterol. And more even than that, it has an impact on their mood and their general sense of well-being and their outlook on life. The other thing that can sometimes happen in more advanced disease is that the overworked breathing muscles, the abnormal breathing pattern and breathlessness may make people lose weight. So there are some people who will gain weight when they're less active. There are some people who will lose weight and become quite wasted when their disease progresses. And physicians have to learn to work with those patients at both extremes to try to maintain proper nutrition and muscle mass. The other thing that happens is that there are going to be some people who can develop circulatory disease in the lung as a manifestation of their emphysema, and those people will develop symptoms that are almost like a certain form of congestive heart failure. And so oftentimes in the pulmonary world, we have to partner up with our cardiology colleagues to co-manage those problems, in particular in people who might have problems with low blood oxygen levels, which can aggravate the lung circulation. And so oftentimes those patients will develop cardiac complications of their lung disease. And again, I don't think that I can emphasize enough just the social implications of it, because people really do get very depressed. People will get withdrawn. No one wants to be seen walking around with their oxygen machine. There are people who are very self-conscious about these things. And while I understand where they're coming from, I think that sometimes part of managing your disease is just accepting it as a fact of life, rolling up your sleeves and getting to work with it. But again, that's easier said than done. And not having experienced that myself, I can speak to it, but I don't think that I really know how it feels as an individual myself.
Very fair comment. Final question, Dr. Waxman. Mm-hmm. Is emphysema something that you can live a normal life expectancy, or should you expect a shortened life expectancy?
Well, as with many diseases, it depends on the severity of the disease. There are millions of people in this country who are walking around with emphysema. And again, it depends on the severity of the disease and whether they continue to smoke. It also includes the fact that the behavior that often led to the emphysema may lead to other diseases. So, for example, people who have emphysema related to tobacco use are at increased risk for different kinds of cancer, not just lung, but bladder and esophagus and so on. They're at increased risk of heart disease. So talking about a person's life expectancy becomes a very complex matter, because you have to decide if they have any of those coexisting conditions. But certainly people with mild COPD who've given up their smoking habit can expect to live a relatively normal life expectancy, although obviously you never know how long they may have lived had they never developed the COPD. But can they live into their late 70s or 80s with COPD? If it's a milder case, then absolutely yes.
Bonus question. What is the recovery process after treatment? How long is the process?
Well, treatment's ongoing. It's like a diabetic, for example. They're never going to come off their insulin or their pills for the diabetes. A person with COPD that needs treatment is never really going to be completely off medication. So there's no recovery period per se, as if there was a discrete treatment that was rendered from which they then have to recuperate. There are, for people who have advanced disease, certain kinds of minimally invasive procedures that we do to try to improve their condition. And for those people, again, there's no recovery period, as you might imagine, from surgery. Generally, these are people who have a procedure that involves an overnight stay. It's called lung volume reduction, and then it just requires ongoing follow-up. So there's no discrete event that takes place in the typical COPD patient. It's more of an ongoing disease management situation.
To make an appointment with Dr. Waxman, you can call 609-621-2080 or from any digital device, demanddebora.org. Dr. Waxman, thank you so much for your time and your talent and your expertise.
Thank you.
Take good care. Have a great day. Really enjoyed learning so much from Dr. Waxman.